Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In March, Russ Ferguson became the new U.S. Attorney for Western North Carolina, an area that encompasses 32 counties in the western third of the state, including this one, Mecklenburg, Union, Gaston, Catawba, Iredell, Lincoln, and Anson counties in our area, as well as the eastern band of Cherokee Indians. U.S. attorneys tend to change with presidential administrations, and Russ Ferguson was appointed by Attorney General Pam Bondi. He will lead an office of nearly 100 federal prosecutors and support personnel and comes to the job with nearly two decades of significant legal experience, including time as a federal prosecutor in Washington and having held leadership roles with the Mecklenburg County Bar. Today, a conversation with Russ Ferguson about the job of U.S. attorney, his priorities in the office, his perspective on justice, and how the wheels of justice should be used, and more. And he joins us for the hour in the studio. Thank you for being here. Good morning.
Well, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Let me begin. I wasn't going to start with this because I didn't know about it yesterday when I was preparing for it, but let me begin with the announcement this morning that a federal grand jury in Charlotte has returned a criminal indictment against Tijuana Brown, a member of Charlotte City Council. What are the charges involved there?
Yeah, and keep in mind, Mike, these are just charges and just allegations, and she's obviously still innocent until proven guilty, and we haven't proven anything yet.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah. That's a refreshing comment.
Yes, well, it is a true one. She is charged with nothing that has anything to do with her city council service at all. It actually predates her city council service. It is a COVID relief fraud case. We've had 35 convictions of this. And basically what the allegations are is that she applied for COVID relief money using false information and false forms. She attached IRS forms that were not real and not actually submitted to the IRS, made false statements on the applications, and got taxpayer money in return. So those are the allegations, and again, just allegations.
I know that going after COVID-19 fraud and Medicaid fraud is going to be one of your thrusts as the U.S. Attorney for the Western District. How long, though, has this been in the works? Because clearly you came into the job in March. It's now May. Were you part of the initial investigations, or did you inherit this, so to speak, from the previous U.S. attorney?
I inherited this. So this investigation started under the previous U.S. attorney, and it does take a while to get a federal case worked up, investigated, get it to a point where we're comfortable making allegations. So that is a very long process, and I came into this after it was well into that process and supervised this case, and it was long in process before I got there.
And she says Tijuana Brown released a press statement yesterday afternoon or early this morning, saying, "I'm not here to be tried by the media or in the media. However, I have to address these allegations." And she says, "I want to be clear: these allegations concern actions that took place before I took office. But these charges, if you are successful in prosecuting them, are serious charges, correct?"
They are, yeah. I mean, I think almost everything that my office handles is serious because we only handle federal crimes and we work with our state partners. But, where a state DA's office has to prosecute every crime, we kind of get the luxury of picking and choosing the best cases. And so it is serious. And we've seen, you know, with the COVID relief money, and pretty much whenever there's federal funding, we see federal fraud. And so we take all of those cases very seriously.
Her two daughters are also part of this indictment. What would be the penalty should you be successful in prosecuting?
That's a good question, Mike, and I don't know. And we don't start with the penalty. We end with the penalty. Mm-hmm. And that will ultimately be up to a federal judge what the penalty is. And in coming up with a sentence, a federal judge will generally use the sentencing guidelines. And in fraud cases, the major driver of the sentence is the amount of loss. So in other words, $100,000 fraud, you will get less of a sentence than someone who engaged in $100 million fraud. And so I don't know what the ultimate sentence will be. And a lot of that depends on, you know, whether we prove these charges and which charges we prove. And a federal judge gives a lot of time and attention to each individual defendant.
So this has to do with the Small Business Administration Economic Injury Disaster Loan and the Paycheck Protection Program and funds that she obtained through those sources allegedly fraudulently. This is part of a pattern that some people were involved in during this COVID-19 era, which was a long time ago in the scheme of things, but you're still getting around to, you and other U.S. attorneys are getting around to going after these people who committed these alleged acts of fraud. The AP found that fraudsters potentially stole more than $280 billion of PPP and other COVID-19 relief money to which they were not entitled. Another $123 billion was wasted or misspent. That's 10% of the money that the government allocated to help people through the worst pandemic in a century. How many of these schemes, this is an outlier, I would take it, how many of these schemes are you aware of, or do you believe have happened? Have you prosecuted? Do you intend to prosecute?
Yeah, well, we don't know how much is out there, and we're continuing to investigate, and the more we dig, I'm sure the more we'll find. So, and we attack these cases two different ways. So we've had about 35 criminal cases. There are cases that are similar to this, where people either fraudulently created forms or made false statements on the loan application. We have other cases where we don't think the person was really being a criminal or having criminal intent, but maybe got the rules wrong. And in those cases, we use the civil process and sue to recover the money for the taxpayers. And we've had a number of those cases. So 35 criminal, a number of others on the civil side. And we'll continue as we get information on these cases to pursue them.
Two people were sentenced, I believe, in April to serve prison time, followed by home confinement and a supervised release, plus the restitution of more than $3 million. How difficult are these cases to prosecute? Because some of these may be just people not knowing what they should or should not have done.
Right. Well, and that's a major concern of mine. So in all of the criminal cases we've had, I don't believe it's a case where someone didn't know. It is classic fraud. It's creating fake documents, lying on applications, you know, signing under penalty of perjury that things are true, making companies that don't exist to get the loan. It's classic fraud. It's what we think of as the difference between right and wrong. Where people have maybe gotten the rules wrong, we will try to get the money back, but we don't try to put them in jail because that was a program that came out very quickly. If you remember, the government was saying, take this money, right? I mean, we wanted to get the economy jump-started, and people did make mistakes. And, you know, they'll repay the money for those mistakes, but we won't go after them in a criminal case.
I mean, in the scheme of the federal budget, $280 billion, it's a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money, but it's a lot of money. And if you are the Trump administration and you want to go after fraud, waste, and abuse, there's fraud.
Yeah. I mean, it is a lot of money. There's 300 million Americans. Some subset of those are taxpayers. If you take out children and everything else, right. I mean, $280 billion is a lot of money out of everyone's pocket. And so we take it very seriously.
And you're also going after other kinds of fraud. Earlier this month, the federal and the state government successfully prosecuted a case in which the clinic owner charged Medicaid for physician home visits that never occurred. And he agreed to a judgment of nearly $5 million, as well as prison time. I would think this is also not necessarily an isolated incident. How was this uncovered, and how often do you find cases like this?
It's very difficult to find because in large part we're relying on the applications from these defendants, and so if the applications aren't true, it's hard to know that.
Now, who goes over those applications? You make an application for a specific amount of money from a specific government program or pot of money. Who decide? Who's the watchdog?
Yeah, so it was mostly the Small Business Administration, but there were a number of watchdogs here. But really what we've done in my office and in conjunction with our law enforcement partners is gone through the applications and tried to match them with other data, whether that's tax returns and tax information or Small Business Administration information or bank documents, and just try to find things that don't match up. It's not an easy process.
So with all of the cutbacks in terms of personnel and funding for programs that have happened as a result of DOGE, will you be able to be as effective as you would have been in the absence of those cuts?
Yeah, that's a great question. That was a huge worry of mine coming in. You know, we had people taking the fork in the road. We've lost people. There's obviously a federal hiring freeze, and so we can't replace those people. But I'll tell you, Mike, the people in my office are incredibly motivated, and they have picked up the slack. We are punching above our weight. We are doing more than we should be able to do with that type of shortage of staff, and we've been able to get it all done.
So. You know, this seems to be a problem that goes throughout the justice system. The shortage of personnel. We know that in Mecklenburg County, this is not your jurisdiction, but in Mecklenburg County, we have a problem. We have a shortage of courtrooms and judges and public defenders and prosecutors. And yet we want to be tough on crime. We want to keep people who are dangerous off the streets, and yet they get released because there's no room in the jail, there's no time to prosecute them, and they commit crimes again. This is like insanity. Why don't we fix this?
Yeah, well, it's a tough problem to fix. I mean, for one thing, it is a sacrifice being a prosecutor or a federal defender or a public defender. I mean, you are taking a sacrifice to do that. It is grueling work, and any one of those lawyers can make a whole lot more money in the public sector, in the private sector. There's no question about that. But it's hard to fix. I mean, for one thing, it's a grueling job. You could pay a lot of people $1 million to do it, and they still wouldn't do it. We have very motivated people who are passionate about it, and we're fortunate to have them. But that's a tough problem to fix. And it's kind of like education. You can throw as much money as you want at it, but you're never going to be happy with the result until crime's totally eliminated.
But if there was is the problem that people don't want to work that hard for that amount of money or any amount of money in that case, or is it that there's not enough money to motivate people to want to take these very difficult jobs?
Yeah, it's not the money. I mean, we get applicants to my office every day. I mean, there's a lot of people that want to be trial attorneys for the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. You know, it would take unlimited money to hire all of them. And so we've got to hire the ones that are the most productive and get the most bang for our buck.
One area of concern, I think, for everybody in the state is whenever a disaster happens, whether mm-hmm. it's a tornado or a flood or a hurricane like Helene, people come in and they try to scam other people. Mm-hmm. It's an opportunity to make money. How much of that? I know that's one of the things that you're also focused on, the Hurricane Helene scams and fraud. How much of that do you know about, or do you think you know about?
I think I know about a lot. I actually know about very little at this point. I mean, like I said, with the COVID release dollars, wherever federal money comes in, there will be fraud. That's just human nature, and we see it. And I think we will see a lot of fraud up in Western North Carolina out of Hurricane Helene. We're working very hard to investigate it, and we will recover the money we can and punish the people we have to.
Do we have any idea how much of this goes undiscovered or unrecovered, or there's something about the case that makes it less than ideal for prosecution, so you decide not to prosecute and people get away with it? Do we know what the ratio is?
I don't know what the ratio is. I mean, I've seen the AP study you talked about where it says it's about 10% is what the guess is, which is a whole lot. I mean, 10% of every dollar out there. But I don't know that we'll ever know. I mean, the fraudsters are always a little bit ahead of the government. And if you're really good at fraud, you might get away with it. Now, we work really hard at it, and we've got some incredible, talented people that come from accounting firms and private law firms. I mean, these are not just your police street police officers that are trying to solve these crimes. These are people who are specialized in financial crimes looking at it. So I like to think that we can find most of it, but you know, I wish that were 100% true.
So we're talking to Russ Ferguson. He's the relatively newly installed U.S. attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. He was sworn in mid-March and has been in the job for a couple of months. He's a Charlotte native, graduate of Duke University. We won't hold that against you.
You're allowed to.
Georgetown University Law Center. Obviously, you were a United States attorney working for the Department of Justice. You are right now. And if you can remember, is this the path? Well, I hear the music, so we're coming up to a break. So I'll ask you the question now and let you think of it. Let it percolate.
Perfect.
When you started out and you decided law is where I want to spend my life, was this where you wanted to be at this stage of your life? Is this something you ever aspired to, or did this just happen? Because a lot of people's careers develop in unexpected ways. I'm curious how it developed for you. We have to take a break. We'll come back and get an answer to that and many more questions in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Russ Ferguson is our guest. He is the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. As I said, a Charlotte native, a Duke graduate, went to Georgetown University Law Center. You're now the United States Attorney for the Western District. When you first started, when you decided, okay, law looks like an interesting career path for me, is this where you wanted to end up? Did you ever think you would end up here? And it's not over yet. This is where you are right now.
Yeah, and that's two different questions. It was certainly a dream to end up here. I mean, I thought early in law school, wow, wouldn't it be amazing to be U.S. attorney? But I never thought it would happen. And you can't really count on being U.S. attorney. You know, it's a lot of stars aligning to get you there, but it was a dream of mine for sure.
And this is not a job that you apply for. This is not a job that they advertise for. This is not a job that you campaign for. So how does this happen to a person? How did you get this job?
Well, I wish I knew. It's a very much a black box process to me. You know, I was in my law office at a law firm one day and got a call on a Thursday that said, you know, you're being considered for U.S. attorney. We'll know more tomorrow. And I said, okay, great. And tomorrow came and went and I never heard anything. So I figured, you know, there's plenty of people in the mix here and someone else got it. That's to be expected. And then I was sitting in court Monday morning and my phone was buzzing and buzzing and buzzing, which, you know, who gets phone calls anymore? And finally got out of court and was dealing with the client and everything. You know, we're very busy. And I finally said, I better return this phone call. And they said, you've been selected. When can you start?
Wow. You have worked in the past as an assistant U.S. attorney in Washington. You clerked for a district judge, Frank Whitney, in the District Court for the Western District of North Carolina. You also spent over a decade as a white-collar criminal defense attorney, and now you represent the prosecutor's office. Talk to me about the difference between being on the defense side and the prosecutorial side.
Yeah, it's extremely different. And you know, I was a prosecutor early in my career, and moving to the defense side I found to be very easy because you get to know a client, you know them as a person, you want to fight for them, even if they did something wrong, you just get to know them as a person, and so it's very easy to represent them. Coming back to the government is a little bit more difficult because my client now is all your listeners. You know, it's the people of the United States, and you don't get to talk to them or get direction from them or see what they're feeling or thinking. So it's a little bit different. I'm very glad I was a defense attorney for 12 years. It gave me a defense mindset. It taught me to think about each defendant independently as a person, and I don't want to lose that. I think me and everyone in my office would rather have 100 people go free that shouldn't than have one innocent person go to jail. And so it's given me the mindset to make sure.
And as you said earlier in the program, under the American system of justice, you are innocent until proven guilty. So the burden of proof is on the prosecution. And as a defense attorney, you know this, you are sometimes put in a position, everybody deserves a defense under our system. And you're sometimes put in a position of defending a client that is guilty.
For sure.
And you're trying to get them off. So tell me how that informs what you do as a prosecutor, because your job is to make sure, if you think they're really guilty, to prove that against the defense saying, well, we'll figure this out. He's going to get off. He or she's going to get off. How does that figure into your mindset?
Well, we've got to have airtight cases. I mean, it is an extremely high burden of proof. Not only do we have to prove every element of every crime, but we have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a very high, and the judge will tell the jury. That's an extremely high standard. And so on the investigative side, we make sure that we're doing and taking all the steps we need to prove these cases, and we are 100% sure the person's guilty before we charge them, at least in our minds. Now, we may be wrong, and a jury may tell us we're wrong, a judge may tell us we're wrong, but we at least feel 100% sure because we take all those steps to get there.
Would it be accurate to say that a prosecutor, whether it's in your office or some other office, doesn't decide to proceed if they don't think they can win?
And we do that all the time. And not only if we think we can't win, but if we're not certain that we can win. I mean, we hold ourselves to a very high standard because just indicting someone can absolutely wreck their life. And we realize that. And it's a serious thing. And so we're not going to do that unless we are certain that a crime has occurred in our minds.
So in instances where you lose in court, and evidently you've won a lot, but in instances—
We lose too, yeah.
In instances where you lose, is it generally because you did not have— You could not exercise the burden of proof. You didn't have what it takes to make the case stick with the jury, who has to be very sure that you're right. Or is it because of other factors that come into play?
I think it's largely because of other factors. I mean, and we don't lose a lot because we bring these airtight cases. I mean, our conviction rate is well north of 90%. Most of our cases plead guilty, and very few actually go to trial. Mm. We do lose. I mean, where we lose cases, there's sometimes there is some sort of investigative misstep. You know, if a police officer searched a car and didn't have a warrant, we're going to lose that case because that evidence is going to be suppressed. And so the evidence we have of wrongdoing won't be introduced to the jury. And then we lose some cases because, you know, a jury feels differently about something. I mean, you know, you might lose a tax case because the IRS isn't popular in the news that week. And the other thing is, we do not know what the defense is going to be. And a criminal defendant has no obligation to tell us their defense until we have already been through our case and sat down and said, "Your Honor, the government rests." And so there may be a defense out there that we haven't predicted. Hmm. And in that case, we should lose. If they've got a real defense and they can convince the jury of it, we shouldn't win that case.
Talk to me, because you said that just being indicted can wreck somebody's life. That's a pretty serious statement. So talk to me about the steps that you go through and others in your office go through before you decide to bring these indictments. How certain are you, and how do you make sure that your certainty is based on fact that bringing this indictment is justified?
Yeah, that's a great question. We do a number of things. I mean, for the first part, before the case even gets to my office, our law enforcement partners have run it down to the end. They've interviewed all the witnesses. They've looked at all the evidence. They've run the forensics. They've taken the drugs to the lab, whatever it may be. It then gets to us. We take another look at it. We ask questions. Sometimes we send them out to do additional investigative work. But in the cases where it can really wreck someone's life, if you think about, you know, indicting an accountant or someone who's going to lose their career over this and it will really wreck their life, we give them an opportunity before we indict them sometimes. The defendant will know, come in. We will make a presentation to them about what we think, and they'll have an opportunity to convince us we're wrong.
And when you, as the U.S. Attorney for the Western District, bring an indictment, these all go through grand juries, don't they?
Correct, yes. Every felony goes through the grand jury.
So it's not just your office deciding we're going to go after this person. It's you put it in front of a grand jury. Talk about that process. We should probably all understand that process, given recent history of what's been going on in very public settings. But talk to me about grand juries, how they work and what they're looking for, because the person is still innocent when they level that indictment. So what is it about what you bring to that grand jury that makes them decide this case is worth prosecuting?
And the grand jury is a very odd process. By rule and by statute, it is a secret process. And the reason for that is because it's all allegations. And if the grand jury decides not to indict someone, we don't want it out there as a society that they've even been investigated or looked at because they didn't do anything wrong. So it's a very secretive process. It is a one-sided process. It is a government-driven process. We present the evidence to the grand jury, which is bigger than a 12-person jury. It's usually maybe 20, 24 people on the grand jury, present the evidence to them, and they are only making a determination of whether it was probable that someone committed a crime. So it is a very low standard. It's not like proving a crime beyond a reasonable doubt at the end of the day. But all they're saying is, you've got enough. So it's really a check on us. You know, if I said, you know, I hate Mike Collins, I'm going to go indict him for drug trafficking, the grand jury would say, well, wait a minute, you don't have any evidence of that. There's no probable cause. So it doesn't it kind of keeps a prosecutor from having a vendetta or going after people. So it's a necessary part of the process, but it's also not a trial. It is not the process we see at the end of the day.
You work for the Justice Department. You were appointed, or I guess Pam Bondi decided you were the guy for the western part of North Carolina. She's the Attorney General. And in modern times, the U.S. Justice Department has allegedly been insulated from politics and has acted independent of the White House and the president. But under this administration, some believe that that firewall has been removed and the Justice Department has become an arm of the White House. Donald Trump has said the Justice Department lawyers are his lawyers, quote, end of quote. He has ordered your boss, Attorney General Pam Bondi, to open criminal investigations into administration critics like Chris Krebs and Miles Taylor. which has raised concerns about the Justice Department becoming a tool for political retribution. Are those unfounded concerns?
I don't think the concerns are unfounded. I think that's a concern that everyone should be thinking about. We can quibble over when that firewall crumbled, whether that was in this administration or earlier in history, and I would submit maybe earlier in history. But, you know, the Department of Justice is an executive agency. The Attorney General sits on the president's cabinet, and the Department of Justice takes priorities and initiatives from the president and always has. The Department of Justice cannot do everything. And so it's the people who the people elect who drives that policy.
So are you saying that the Justice Department was politicized far earlier than the current or the previous Trump administration?
I'm not saying it's politicized now, but I'm saying I don't think that it has changed as much as maybe people think it has.
Well, Attorney General Bondi defended an executive order that targeted law firms that Trump seeks to punish. She called a judge's ruling against that a blatant overstepping of judicial power. Several firms have capitulated to that by offering legal services in the hundreds of millions of dollars to causes that Donald Trump believes in or says he believes in. You've been in the legal profession for a long time. You've worked for a major law firm as a civil defense attorney. Is this the kind of thing that the White House or other parts of the executive branch, including the Justice Department, should be engaged in?
So the job of the Justice Department is to defend the United States wherever it appears in court. And so the United States is sued all the time, and my office defends every single one of those suits. And that could be a TSA agent who someone says, you know, hey, they stole my laptop. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but we'll defend the TSA in that case. Or it could be a VA doctor who was negligent in providing care. We'll defend that VA doctor if they're acting within the scope of their government authority. And just like the Justice Department will defend the president when the president is sued. That doesn't mean we'll win every case, but that is the job of the Justice Department, is to defend the United States when it is sued in court.
We're not talking about defense here. We're talking about prosecution. We're talking about the president of the United States going after law firms and threatening them with removing their security clearances so they can't defend their clients, and therefore they are at risk of losing their clients. And then the Justice Department saying that's okay. That's not the same thing.
Well, the actions of the president or the executive order, the actions of the Department of Justice were stepping in when the president was sued for those executive orders. So it was a defense case. I mean, the Department of Justice was defending the president.
But my question was, is this something that the Justice Department and the White House and other branches of the government should be involved in, going after private law firms for things that they don't like?
Well, whether going after law firms or not, I mean, that's up to the president. That has nothing to do with the Department of Justice. But it does.
You have to prosecute something that is either legal or illegal, and that doesn't sound legal to me. It doesn't sound American to me.
Well, all we do is defend when people sue and say what you said, that that's illegal. We'll defend the United States, and we have a judiciary process that will decide that. And that's decided by an independent judiciary in a different branch of government, as it should be.
Well, let me ask you this, as a person who used to work for a law firm, should law firms be capitulating or even feel that they have to consider capitulating to a high executive in the federal government just so that they won't face recriminations, that they won't lose clients, they won't lose income? Is that how the legal system in this country has traditionally worked or should work now or in the future?
Well, you know, law firms are private businesses and they all make decisions on what kind of cases they'll take and what they do based on a variety of factors. And we've seen a number of law firms pop up just to sue the Trump administration. So I think that hole has been filled. But if you're a law firm that's operating and defending companies before regulatory agencies, I mean, they make those decisions all the time on what kind of clients they want to have. And not just on government topics. I mean, if you represent Home Depot, you're probably not going to represent Lowe's or Coke and Pepsi. I mean, law firms are private businesses. There's a ton of them for a reason, so that there's always a lawyer to step into a hole and fill it. But law firms make decisions like that every day.
But doesn't it damage the legal profession? Doesn't it damage the legal system if there's this fear of retribution by defense attorneys or law firms who defend clients that may have something to do with the federal government? Doesn't that hamper justice?
Well, I don't think it has. I mean, I think we've seen law firms created for that purpose to challenge the Trump administration. And, you know, it's lawyers' job is not to.
But as you say, people sue the federal government all the time. They've sued them under the Biden administration. They sued them under the Obama administration. They sued them under both Bush administrations. Forever. But there were never these cases of threats.
Well, there's also never been more lawsuits against the government or the president than there are now.
Is that are they justified, these lawsuits, or is it because he is fomenting these lawsuits? He loves it.
I don't know if he loves it or not. But you know, I think our justice system is not based on what one side does. It is based on both sides fighting. And so whatever the president does, I think our justice system will work as long as there are people fighting on both sides. And so far there have been.
So what do you see as the role of the Justice Department in our legal system? And do you see that role changing today?
I think the role of the Justice Department is to be a zealous advocate for the United States in whatever that case may be. So if that's a criminal prosecution, we're going to be zealous advocates for the United States and trying to put that person behind bars.
Is the United States the people of the United States, or is the United States the president?
The United States is the people of the United States.
Talk to me for a moment about maintaining the rule of law in a healthy democracy.
What do you mean?
Well, it seems to me that some of the things that the Trump administration is trying to do are at least pushing the envelope on what traditionally has been considered legal or not legal, and trying to get away with that. And if it's not legal and they get away with it, then you've broken the rule of law. We'll talk about this after the break a little bit, and that is the fact that he seems to be willing to and may in fact be thwarting court orders. And if you do that, the rule of law doesn't exist. So what is the importance of the rule of law?
Well, I think you have to follow court orders. I don't think there's any question that our legal system depends on people following court orders. And courts have tremendous power to enforce their court
orders.
Do they? I think they do. They
have
tremendous power. They can hold you in contempt. They can fine you every day.
What does that mean to be held in contempt?
Contempt can mean a lot of different things. And there's civil contempt and there's criminal contempt. Mm-hmm. But it basically means that they can put some sort of onerous punishment on you until you comply.
But not on the president. He's immune.
Well, they can put onerous protections on the administration or on the government.
Like what?
They could, if they wanted to shut down an agency or restrict funding for an agency, courts can do that. If they want to direct a certain action, they can do that. Courts have tremendous power, particularly when it comes to...
I actually want to come back to that, because it seems to me that the executive branch owns the military. The courts have nothing to fight back with, except these things that you're talking about, and they could be ignored. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. In Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE, I'm Mike Collins. Russ Ferguson is with us. He is the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, appointed in March by Pam Bondi. He works for the Justice Department, and we're talking about the rule of law and the importance of the rule of law in the United States, because we are a country governed by the rule of law, at least traditionally we have been, and that has allowed us to flourish in the international marketplace. Businesses are here because they can depend on the rule of law, as they cannot in other countries. And we know that Donald Trump, by nature, pushes the envelope. He wants to get as far as he can get and see how far it goes. And we were talking before the break about courts who stand in the way of illegality and who will push back on the executive branch. And their tools are what? They are sanctions. They are contempt of court. But the president is now immune because of the Supreme Court ruling several years ago. So he can't be touched. There are people within the administration, I suppose, who could go to jail for contempt of court, etc. But really, they can be pardoned immediately. So what power does the court really have against an executive branch that's going to have its way come hell or high water?
Yeah, and we're talking about the courts. I mean, keep in mind that Congress can obviously indict the president and remove him from office. I mean,
they
that's
won't.
A constitutional process, but they can't. And that's the process we have. And, you know, when you're elected by a political process, that's the process that our Constitution gives us. But the courts still have a lot of power, I think. I mean, the president has a lot of power, too. Don't get me wrong. But the courts have power to enforce court orders, and they have stopped a lot of actions, and they can keep the administration from implementing rules,
well,
regulations.
I'm only going down this path because the administration has been ignoring a Supreme Court order, a 9-0 ruling from that's rare in these days, to facilitate the return of Kilmer Abrego Garcia. He's one of the men that was deported to that prison in El Salvador, and the High Court ruled that the administration must take steps to bring him back. So far, they have not. Yesterday, a federal judge ordered the government to maintain custody of migrants on a deportation flight to South Sudan, something the judge said appeared to violate an injunction he issued back in April. And during a hearing, Trump officials said they could not say where the flight was or where it was going, and the judge raised the specter of criminal sanctions for the pilots of the plane and for those within the administration who were aware of the judge's order not to do this. The judge said, quote, based on what I have been told, this seems like it may be contempt. Is it?
I don't know. And to the president's credit, you know, that's one district court judge, and he does get an appellate process for contempt, for sure.
But if the judge says, don't fly these men out of the country, and you fly the men out of the country, and then you say you don't know where the plane is, come on.
Yeah, well, the president wasn't flying the plane, and I don't know if that plane left from the court's jurisdiction.
That didn't happen without his okay. You know it didn't happen without his okay. You know it didn't happen without people in the administration's okay. This is the playbook.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened, and that
so if that's the playbook, is that within the bounds of the rule of law?
So I don't know the specific facts of that. Is it within the bounds of the rule of law to defy a court order? No, our court orders. Always clear. Are they subject to appeal? Yes.
So if he continues to defy the court order, if he doesn't bring these prisoners back from El Salvador, if he continues to send migrants who may be dangerous and should not be here, they should not be here in the first place, but in the second place, if they're dangerous and they're violent criminals, they should be dealt with. But should they not be dealt with due process?
Yeah, that's a good question. The Supreme Court has said they do get due process. And that was a question at one point. If you're not a citizen, does the Constitution apply to you? And largely it doesn't, but due process does. And that's what immigration court is for. That has nothing to do with my office.
And in the president's defense, we do have an immigration problem that could be solved if Congress did their job. And this is not particular to this Congress. This goes back decades.
For
they
sure.
just don't want to reform immigration for whatever the reason may be. And if you have thousands of people coming across the border every day, you have to stop it at some point. He's done that. He stopped it. And this threat of being sent to South Sudan if you cross the border and we're going to deport you, it's probably playing a role in that. So there's no question that that's happening. But is it worth destroying the legal system of the United States of America to do it?
Nothing is worth destroying the legal system of the United States of America. I do think the scope of the immigration problem is playing a role in this. I mean, we're talking about a handful of deportations, an administration that has deported a record number of people who are here illegally. And so I do think the scope has played some role in this. But nothing is more important than American democracy. And you know, don't forget that the president was democratically elected, too, by people who wanted him to be aggressive. I mean, he did not keep this a secret on the campaign trail. People knew what they were getting when they elected Donald Trump.
Right. But I don't think people would want him to break the law. I mean,
no one wants
no one's above the law, allegedly, in this country. I'm not sure that's true. But allegedly, that is true.
I believe it's true. Yeah.
Donald Trump recently said he didn't know whether he had to uphold the Constitution. He had lawyers who would do that, he said. How does that answer strike you? He took an oath. I don't think he put his hand on the Bible this time, if you look at the video.
He did,
but he took an oath.
He took an oath, and he took an oath to uphold the Constitution, and I don't think there's any denying that. I think the point he's getting at is that every word in the Constitution has been so lawyered, and I say this as a lawyer, that you can't take something in the Constitution for the words that are there anymore. It has to have all these Supreme Court cases behind it. Every word means something beyond that word. And so the role of the president is one of those things, and what the president can and can't do. I mean, we've seen the Supreme Court grapple with constitutional issues over and over again.
Not with that phrase. And that phrase is in the oath of office is in the Constitution, if I'm not mistaken.
It is, yes.
Solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute, defend. I've forgotten the exact words.
Yes. So help me God.
So help me God.
Yes. No, that's true. And I think he knows he has to uphold the Constitution, but it's what the Constitution means today that's very much in question.
Why?
Because the court is saying what the Constitution means all the time.
They always have.
They always have, absolutely. But as time goes on, the Constitution gets more and more complex. And as we have people out there saying, well, the Constitution's a living document, and it changes by the day, what does to uphold a document that changes by the day mean? I think that's a legitimate question.
So the question that elicited that response, that I don't know whether I have to uphold the Constitution, came from Kristen Welker at NBC's Meet the Press in a discussion about these mass deportations and the constitutional right to due process. Can you think of an instance where due process would not apply?
Well, I cannot now, but I can tell you the Supreme Court could. In the 1960s, they considered whether due process applies to non-citizens. And I think that is a legitimate question for the court. Does the Constitution of the United States of America apply to people that are not citizens of the United States of America? For due process, it does, because the Supreme Court said so, not because the Constitution says so.
So when you say who are not citizens, are you talking about people who are not here legally? Because there are a lot of people who are not here, who are here, who are not citizens. People vacationing from France, from other foreign countries, are here. They're not citizens. So if they are accused of a crime, they don't deserve due process?
Of course they deserve due process. Well, but that was not a settled question, just a few decades ago. At some point, the benefits of the United States do stop. I mean, if you're here vacationing from France, you don't get Medicare. If you fall ill, you've got to pay for it, or your insurance has to pay for it. So at some point, the benefits of being an American do stop for people who are not citizens.
Two days ago at a congressional hearing, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem testified that the president has the power to suspend habeas corpus. Does he?
That's in the Constitution. The president absolutely has the power.
Under what circumstances?
I don't know what the language in the Constitution is, but I think under emergency situations, acts of war, things like that, he has the power to suspend habeas corpus.
Last time I checked, we're not at war.
Well, that depends on how you define war, I guess.
The Constitution defines war, and it says that the Congress has the power to declare war. Congress has not declared war.
But it also says you can suspend habeas corpus during times of invasion.
Who's invading us?
Well, the president makes the argument that illegal immigrants are invading us at the border. Maybe a court will decide that question, but I do think there's an argument.
She called habeas corpus, or the suspension of habeas corpus, a constitution. Actually, she called habeas corpus a constitutional right that allows the president to remove people from the country. And White House Deputy Chief of Staff and Homeland Security Advisor Stephen Miller has floated the idea of suspending habeas corpus to fast-track mass deportations. We know that the immigrants who were sent to El Salvador had no due process, which has traditionally been considered a constitutional protection, at least in modern times. Is due process now something that can be suspended when the administration does not like the mess that it creates? And if so, do we have rule of law?
Well, the ability of the president to suspend habeas corpus is enshrined in the Constitution. It's up to our courts over when he can do that. I will note no one has suspended habeas corpus yet. And I do think that everyone's entitled to due process. And I do think you should get due process before you're deported, just because the risk that we may deport someone wrongly. And I think that process, is not a perfect process. And there will be mistakes and things that have to be fixed by appellate courts and things like that. But I do think, we're deporting thousands of people a day. And most of those people, 99.99%, are getting a hearing and properly being deported. The other thing is a lot of these people being deported already have final orders of deportation. They've already gone through their due process, been ordered to leave the country, and have not.
Okay. But it seems like almost like the Doge cuts, that we're not doing it on a case-by-case basis. How certain are we that the people that we are sending on these flights to these foreign countries and sometimes to prisons in foreign countries where they will languish likely for the rest of their lives. How certain are we that they are the people who have been given their due process but didn't leave, overstayed their welcome, and are breaking yet another law? How certain are we that most of those people have been given that opportunity?
And I may not know that any more than you do because that's in the Department of Homeland Security, but I think in the handful of cases where that has broken down, we've heard a whole lot about it. So I think that...
Does the Justice Department pull rank on the Department of Homeland Security? I mean, you're there to administer justice. If they're breaking the law at the Department of Homeland Security, shouldn't you be investigating them?
Congress can investigate the Department of Homeland Security as a cabinet agency. If someone sues the Department of Homeland Security, we'll defend them in court. But we do not exercise oversight over other cabinet agencies as the Department of Justice.
As I said in the beginning, it is common practice at the turnover of presidential administrations for all of the U.S. attorneys to be replaced across the country. Usually they resign out of, I guess it's a pro forma thing. They just resign because it's a new president coming in and they have the right to pick their own staff of U.S. attorneys. Donald Trump used the term fired. He's saying he fired all the U.S. attorneys because the Department of Justice had been politicized like never before. Do you think that was true then? And if it was true then, is it true now?
And first of all, the firing of U.S. attorneys started with Bill Clinton in 1993. He fired all 93 U.S. attorneys. In my district, we had a fantastic U.S. attorney that preceded me, Dena King, and she resigned before that happened. So no one was fired here as a U.S. attorney. You know, like most department officials, they do switch with the administration. But if you look at most U.S. attorney districts in the country right now, The U.S. attorneys have mostly resigned, but there is still an acting U.S. attorney there that was there during the Biden administration. President Trump has appointed very few U.S. attorneys so far.
But he said that the Justice Department, he said this many times, has been politicized like it's never been before, meaning that Joe Biden's administration politicized it and took up cases that went against him. And it wasn't just the federal government that went against Donald Trump. It was New York State and the state of Georgia, et cetera. Was it true, do you think, that the Department of Justice was politicized under Joe Biden and went after Donald Trump for illegitimate reasons? And is it true today that the Department of Justice has been politicized by Donald Trump to go after? Because you've just gone after Andrew Cuomo in a political season. You've just gone after Tijuana Brown on Charlotte City Council. Now, this has nothing to do with her time on council, this indictment that came down this morning, but it is a political season. So what are we to read into that?
Well, and on Tijuana Brown, we were very careful to bring that indictment as early as possible so that it is not on the heels of an election. And like I said earlier, that investigation started under the prior administration, and I saw it through. But we worked with Maine Justice to be sure that that was not seen as a political indictment, and it is not. It has nothing to do with her public service. It started before she was on council, and it's indicted, I think, enough before an election so that hopefully we can get it resolved before.
What about Andrew Cuomo? Because the Justice Department dropped charges against the sitting mayor in the city of New York for reasons that are completely unknown, but he's running against Andrew Cuomo, and there are charges now pending against Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah, and that investigation's obviously not in my district, so I don't know a whole lot about those facts or how long that investigation has been pending. I could tell you federal investigations take a very long time, and so I would not be surprised if that investigation was pending a long time. And of course, that process is secret because we're not going to go out there and say we're investigating this person and that person because it puts a layer of guilt on someone who maybe doesn't.
We kind of got sidetracked today because of the Tijuana Brown thing.
Yeah.
I'm out of time, and I wanted to talk about your thrust in terms of going after gangs and gang activity, because I think you say that there are a lot of crimes in this city that are being committed by gangs from out of state, out of the country. MS-13 comes to mind, and that they are recruiting young people. You have 36.
Well, everything you just said is true, and it is astounding since I've been in this job to see that so much of the violent crime here and the drug crime that supports the violent crime has been gangs and cartels that we can connect to other countries and see that they're getting instructions from other countries, they're bringing in recruits from other countries, and they're preying on our school children to build up their gangs here. And it is terrifying. It keeps me up at night, and I'm doing everything I can to stop it.
That's one of your focus, also the control of the fentanyl traffic. And we didn't get a chance to talk about child pornography and AI. And to be clear, AI-generated child pornography is just as illegal as real child pornography, because it is child pornography.
It absolutely is, and I hope you'll have me back to talk about all those things.
Okay. Russ Ferguson is the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. Thank you for the hour.
Well, thank you for having me.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.